So, here we go. Dear Ajahn, how can people suffering during a natural disaster be explained in Buddhist terms? Is it karma, or were they simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, or is it a combination of the two? I think that's a good question, because it's often difficult to understand how in a natural disaster every single person in a certain area can have bad karma. Doesn't kind of make sense. So I think you're quite right. It probably is a combination of the two. When you have, you know, an earthquake somewhere, a tsunami, or some kind of natural disaster, probably some of the people who are there had some bad karma, and they then died or suffered as a consequence. Whereas many others, it probably was just a matter, as you say, of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sometimes human life is very fragile, and sometimes we get into these situations whereby human life is just short, whether you have bad karma or not. It's one of the things that you can expect as a human being, is that sometimes life gets cut off before it's supposed to, normally it's before the average lifespan or whatever. But sometimes it's also the case that if you have very good karma and you have done, you know, the right things in the past life, that can actually support you to avoid even natural disasters, I think. We often hear stories about somebody who was supposed to die, right, in some kind of natural disaster or terrorist attack. Usually they would be in that place. But for some reason, they were somewhere else at that particular time. And that could be maybe the outcome of good karma, perhaps, in those situations. And one of the things that you see in the Buddhist teachings is that the Buddha does not say that short life always is the result of bad karma. What he says that bad karma, or killing in the past, will lead to short life in the future life. So if you do bad karma, it will definitely lead to short life or to some other kind of problem. But he does not say that short life is always the outcome of bad karma. These are not the same. These are not equivalent things. So sometimes it's short life simply because you were, maybe because you were careless, right? Don't think, yeah, I've got good karma, I don't really have to take care. Please don't think like that, because then you might be in for a very unpleasant surprise if you do it that way. There's some famous examples. There's a story, I don't know if this is a real story or not, but apparently in some Buddhist countries you have all these amulet things. You buy amulets, and they're supposed to be very protective. And sometimes people have so much faith in these amulets. There's one story of a man who said, well, now you can take this gun and you can shoot me because this amulet will protect me. And he did so, and he died, right? It's crazy. This is really a stupid way of living your life. And even if you have incredibly good karma, that is not the way to test. Don't test these things, right? You're bound for some serious problems if you do that. Okay. So let's go on to the next one. Ajahn, is there a sutta where the Buddha explicitly states that one cannot see or know all conditions other than the sutta about ignorance? If one cannot know all conditions, it would seem Buddhism is not deterministic, right? It is, you know, whether Buddhism is not is deterministic or not doesn't really have anything to do with whether you can see these things. Whether you can see all conditions is one thing. Whether things are deterministic, whether there are conditions that are there but that you can't see, is something else. It is not necessarily the fact that you can see everything that's going on. But whether Buddhism is deterministic or not is really quite irrelevant, because if you look inside of yourself, it feels like we have an ability to determine how we act. We have an ability to decide whether to do right or wrong. That's what it feels like, and you act on that feeling. You do your very best to live your life well. And you act on the feeling inside that you are independent. Whether ultimately it is deterministic or not is kind of irrelevant. It's one of those nice points of philosophy, and you can argue forever. And some people say it is deterministic, some people say it's not, some people change their mind back and forth. And sometimes you just give up at really finding an answer to those things. It doesn't matter. Act rightly. Act on the feeling inside that you have, that you have a sense of freedom about these things. At the same time, it's also very useful to know the limitations of your freedom. And if you look carefully at your own life, you will see how conditioned it is, how conditioned your choices are, conditioned by your upbringing, conditioned by all the influences that you've had on you. And when you see that, when you understand how conditioned each one of us is, it's also much easier to forgive yourself, right? It means that you are not really as responsible for your acts as you think you are. Other people, too, are not responsible for their acts to the extent that we normally think they are. And then you can start to forgive. You understand that we are each one of us, we are prisoners of our personalities, prisoners of our past, prisoners of our habits, prisoners of what we have done in our past lives. We are running on a program that was written in part a long, long, long time ago. And now you're playing out the consequences of that program that you wrote in the past. When you see it in that way, it's much easier to have compassion, right? People are victims, in a way, of these programs they wrote themselves in the past. And then you can have compassion for them. There's this feeling that we are autonomous agents that make us ultimately completely responsible for everything. If we are completely autonomous agents in the world, we are fully responsible for everything. The less autonomous we are, the less responsibility we have. And so there's this balance between the two things. I find the idea of non-self means that the amount of autonomy we have is, if it isn't zero, it is certainly very close to zero. So these perceptions are actually can be very useful to help us to let go of things and purify ourselves. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, what are the three types of sila, body, speech, and mind? Please could you explain the type of actions? Thank you very much. Thank you and much metta. Okay, so it just means bodily action is just what we do by body, right? It's kind of whatever bodily thing we do. The typical things that is the way it is explained in the suttas, bodily actions are the bad ones, is like killing or harming living beings. And stealing, right? And then we have the idea of sexual misconduct, which are the three types of bodily misbehavior. And speech is all about lying and that kind of stuff, lying and divisive speech and harsh speech and idle chatter. That's the typical typical way that speech is divided up in the suttas. We're going to look at this more later on. And the mind bad conduct is the conduct which, strong desire for other people's property. Covetousness is the word usually used in English. You covet, what does it say in the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property or something like that. I don't know the Ten Commandments, to be honest with you, but I kind of heard these ones in passing. I wasn't really brought up in a religious way at all, so I'm pretty clueless about those things. But it's very similar to that. And then there is the strong kind of hatred, anger. May these beings die, may they perish. That's how it's described in the suttas. And then there's wrong view. Wrong view is actually one of the bad silas of the mind, bad habits of the mind. The idea that there is no rebirth, no karma, no result of bad actions. You do bad actions, no worries, just chill, it's fine. Do whatever you like. That's kind of that kind of attitude. So that is what it is. We're going to go into this in much more detail later on, so that's just a little bit of a preview for you here. Okay, dear Ajahn, once a little child asked me, what is mind? Mind is the brain. If not, where is it? I would like to know, how would you explain to a little child? Thanks. What is mind? Mind is your experience. The experience you have right now, that is your mind. So whatever it is, you experience, I experience the lights, the ceiling, I experience fellow monastics, I experience all these meditators here, good company, I experience the night outside. Right? That is experience. Whatever you experience through the senses, that is the mind. Is it the brain? I would say definitely not. It just doesn't feel like the brain, what I'm experiencing now. So it's not. It's just here. It's just what you experience. It's the universe, basically, your personal universe. That is the mind. Okay, so I hope that helps. See what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, is the Metta Sutta we chant by not holding to false views? Please kindly explain false views. Thank you. So false views is ideas that are not correspond to the way the world actually is, right? And the kind of the big false views from a Buddhist point of view is that there is no one of them is that life is, things are eternal. You die and then you keep on going for eternity afterwards into some happy state. That is one of the false views in Buddhism. It's called eternalism. And eternalism is not where things are at according to the Buddhist teachings. And a lot of the world's religions, that's exactly what they teach. They teach eternalism one way or another. In ancient India, it was the Brahmanical teaching that was eternalism. You kind of unify with Brahma and then you hang out with Brahma until eternity. And that's very nice because Brahma is very kind of kind and all of these kind of things. That's a wonderful thing. So it's a very beautiful idea. Satchit Ananda is what it's called in Brahmanism. The existing mind bliss is kind of literally what it means. But most major religions have some similar idea of eternal happiness after. And Buddhism is different. It doesn't have that. It doesn't have this idea of eternal happiness ever after. So that is one wrong view. And the opposite wrong view is what we call annihilationism. And that is the idea that when you pass away, you are finished forever. Everything just bites to dust and everything is finished. There's nothing more happens afterwards. That is the other extreme. And the Buddhist teaching is in the middle and it's called dependent arising. And dependent arising is precisely how impermanent things that are actually impermanent, things that are always changing, how they replicate themselves and continue into the future when you pass away. This is kind of the really weird thing about dependent origination. It shows how an impermanent entity, such as a human being or anything, can actually keep on going after they pass away. Most people say that's impossible if you're going to keep on living after death. It means, by definition, that you have a permanent essence inside. But no, that is exactly what dependent origination shows you. You don't need a permanent essence to carry on after you die. That is a Buddhist middle way, one way of describing that middle way. So these are wrong views. And of course, part of that is the idea of rejecting rebirth, right? That is same as annihilationism, or rejecting karma. Even though there is rebirth, you can just keep on do whatever you like because it doesn't have any results. And I think if you are a little bit sensitive to your own life and your own existence, you will actually know that every act you do has a result. Every time you do something, if you are kind to somebody, you feel good about it afterwards. That's basic karma in the here and now. Do something bad, you feel bad about it afterwards. So you can actually know for yourself that these things are wrong views. Another very important wrong view, and this is like perhaps the most basic of all wrong views, and that is that there is nobody in the world who has that spiritual ability to penetrate and see these things for themselves. The idea that being a Buddha is impossible, that there are no spiritual teachers who have this kind of insight. This is a very basic wrong view, because then you can't even get started on the Buddhist path. There's no way you're going to listen to anyone. So you have to have this sense that there are people in this world who practice this path and who discover this life and the other life, who can see the reality of rebirth and all of these kind of things. That is a very important part of it. So those are some of the aspects of wrong view, of false views, that is talked about in the Metta Sutta. I think that's probably some of the most important things. There's probably other things that could be brought up, but maybe that's the most important things for now. So let's let's go on. Huh? Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, what does it mean by feeling the Dhamma? How does it feel when one sees the Dhamma? How, where to verify, to confirm one is seeing the correct Dhamma? Thank you, Ajahn Brahmali. Okay. Seeing the Dhamma. What does it mean to seeing the Dhamma? Okay. So what that means, it means many different things, and it depends on the depth of that seeing, right, whether you are seeing it or not. But seeing the Dhamma in the most profound sense means that you become a noble person, you become an Aryan, you become somebody who has penetrated all the way to the core of reality. Reality meaning the reality of what it is to be a human being. You have seen your mind to its root, you have seen non-self and these kind of things. That is really what it means. So that is the true teaching, the true kind of seeing of the Dhamma. This is very profound. And before you get to this point, you must have very profound samadhi already, very profound stillness of mind, a lot of bliss, very powerful mindfulness. All of these factors must be in place before it is possible to see these things. It is hard to see because it goes so against our ordinary outlook. Yeah, it's very, very the opposite, almost exact opposite of how we normally look at the world. And for that reason, it takes a lot of strength of mind to be able to do that, a lot of samadhi, etc. But on the way there, there's a lot of lesser seeing of the Dhamma. Yeah, and in the Dhamma, it says the Dhamma is sanditika, it is visible here and now. And what that means is aspect of that is that it is possible to see how the Dhamma works in the present moment. If you, in the present moment, turn your mind in a different direction, right? Instead of right now, you kind of think a positive thought, really coming from your heart, really wishing other people well. You sit down, you do your meditation, you wish may all beings be well and happy, or may this particular person be well and happy. And you really mean that in your heart. You can actually see how that goodness correlates with a positive feeling straight away. Or you can see how not being kind, the opposite, often correlates with a negative and unpleasant feeling. And this is like seeing the Dhamma in the present moment, seeing the causal relationship between how you use your mind and how you feel as a consequence of how you use your mind. And this is a very, in many ways, a more useful way of understanding how the Dhamma works, because it encourages you, it gives you the motivation to practice, because you see the power of your own actions, the power of your own intentions. That's what you see there. Our intentions, how we use our mind, is so powerful on how we experience our own life, how we experience our own existence. And of course, it has a very powerful impact on the people around us at the same time. So this is perhaps a more useful way of looking at the seeing the Dhamma in action. So how do you verify to confirm one is seeing the correct Dhamma? Well, you just keep on. If the feeling is good, right, the more right that feeling is, the more clarity you have, the more stillness you have in the mind, the more bliss you are experiencing, the happiness you are experiencing, all of these things, they are kind of pointing you that you are in the right direction. Until one day, bang, you see really profound insight, and you see something that you have never seen before, and then maybe you have seen something incredibly profound. If you see something really profound, then I would recommend you go to Ajahn Brahm and say, Ajahn, I have seen this. What is it? And he will say, relax, keep on going. Sometimes it is profound, but it's not. Still more to go, right? And you keep on going. That's often how it is. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, you use the term yoniso manasikara or something. Yeah, you didn't quite get it right, but that's okay. I kind of covered up your mistake in here, so that's okay. You're fine. So what exactly does it mean? It was in the context of clear intention. So I think I explained this already, but yoniso manasikara means like basically wise attention, the ability to turn your mind in the right direction. So it gives rise to positive states, states that move you forward on the path, rather than states that move you away from the path. The opposite is ayonisomanasikara, the opposite of wise attention. Maybe we should translate that as stupid attention. Yeah, opposite of wise is kind of stupid. Or maybe that's a bit pejorative. Maybe we have to be careful what we say, otherwise people might complain about that. Here's another one about yonisomanasikara. Please, could you explain a bit more about what yonisomanasikara means? Okay, so these are the old questions from yesterday. Okay, so I hope you have some clarity. If you still have questions about yonisomanasikara, please come back again tomorrow and then we try again here. Ajahn Brahmali, when a cause is worth fighting for, how does one do this and not get attached? Can you let go and fight at the same time with metta? You can to some extent, right? There is some degree to which you can be an activist and that sort of stuff. But the point really is that if you're going to do things, then do it because you want to be helpful, right? You have compassion for people. You have compassion for the world. Do it out of some kind of goodness inside of you. And if you do it out of goodness inside of you, then it will be a supportive thing in your practice of Buddhism. You come back to this retreat, you feel that you have supported the world, done the right thing, and it will help your meditation practice. I have always found that one of the dangers of activism is that people often get angry, right? They want to do things instead of actually, instead of supporting other people, they get angry. And when you're angry, you are deluded. Anger distorts the mind. You don't really know anymore what is the best way of supporting others. And people often say, I have to be angry because that gives me energy. Well, that's crazy stuff. In the long run, that's going to deplete you of energy. It's going to make you more tired and more, it's going to have negative consequences. So yes, do good things in the world. Do the right thing. But don't get too caught up in it. If you get too caught up in these kind of things, it ends up destroying your practice rather than being a positive contribution to your meditation practice. And I have always, I think that the most, in terms of living an ethical and moral life, the most powerful aspect of living a moral life, ethical life, is not so much the big picture morality, right? Fighting against climate change, fighting for social justice and all of these kind of things. All of these things are great, but what really has a much more personal impact on you is how you deal with the people who are close to you. That is what really matters. And that is why we see in the suttas the Buddha always talking about how we deal with our parents. Incredibly powerful karma, because these are some of the people who are the closest to us. Yeah, that is what really, really matters. How we deal with the noble ones. Yeah, the noble ones in our life, treat them well. Then how we deal with our friends, the people who are closest to us, my fellow monastics, how you deal with the fellow people in the Buddha society, people here on the retreat, your other family members. Because that is where you make much stronger karma usually than in the big picture things. And then if you're able to do some other things on top of that, great. But do not neglect the people who are closest to you, because that, I think, is by far the most important thing. If we have harmony between the monks and the monastery, it means that the monastery is peaceful, your mind is at ease, you are relaxed about things, and then your meditation becomes possible. If we have disharmony in the monastery between the monks, atmosphere is very unpleasant, your mind is in turmoil, you go back to your kuti, you can't meditate, and the whole thing kind of becomes hopeless. So that is how I look at this. There is, as usual, as always, there is no black and white answer, yes or no. It is how you do things that really matters. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, can lay people attain stream entry, sotapanna, if they have family life, expectations for material comfort? These, I thought, come with inherent attachments and a sense of I. May I hear your thoughts, please? Thank you, Sadhu. It is possible, perhaps. I think it is quite difficult. It is not an easy thing to do. There were family people at the time of the Buddha who seemed to have been stream enterers. But it's not so easy, of course, because you have so many responsibilities, so much to do. Your life is so full when you live a family life with children and everything like that. It makes it much harder to do these things. But it's not impossible. But what really matters is not so much whether you become a stream enter or not. Try not to think so much in those terms, because if you think too much in those terms, you kind of give rise to all kind of desires, all kind of things that actually may stop you from practicing well. All you need to know is that you are moving in that direction. You're moving towards awakening. You are gaining more clarity in life, gaining more happiness. That is what matters. So ask yourself whether your general state of happiness is increasing, whether the problems are decreasing, whether you feel that you are more mindful, whether you are softer and more gentle inside, whether you have more time for other people. These are the things that matter. These are the things that give you quality of life, right? Whether you are a stream enter or not, of course it is going to give you quality of life, but it's kind of, it's theoretical, yeah? Instead of going by that kind of theory, go by your real experience. And if your real experience is showing you that you're heading in the right direction, then you know you're doing the right thing. That is really all that matters. And your family life can become a field for spiritual practice, yeah? So if you live your family life well, then you're also, not only do you create a much better family life, but you're also improving your spiritual practice at the same time. It's a wonderful thing. It's a win-win situation. You can't go wrong with that kind of thing. So when you are, have more kindness to your closest family members, it's a very powerful way of practicing the Buddhist path. But don't worry too much about stream entry. Know that you're heading in the right direction, then one day you will come there. Perhaps even on your deathbed, right? Deathbed is usually a very good time too for these things to happen. Okay, so that is the questions from leftovers from yesterday. So here we go with today's questions. Dear Ajahn, could you kindly explain the proper method to develop and grow the wisdom faculty here with much metta? Okay, how to develop the wisdom faculty. And the answer is that to develop the wisdom faculty, that's one of the things that we're kind of looking at yesterday, the idea of where does the Buddhist path start. It starts off with the Sapurisa, the superior people. So one of the ways of developing the wisdom faculty to begin with is to just read and contemplate and reflect on the suttas of the Buddha. And when you reflect on those suttas, and that kind of starts to shift your view a little bit, because you understand that there's something going on here which is true, and that helps you to practice better, that already, you're actually already growing in wisdom. It enables you to apply yoniso manasikara better. You see what the Buddha has to say about, well, how do I overcome anger in a good way? How do I overcome these defilements of the mind? And you see what the Buddha has to say about that. And when you apply that, then you are already using a sense of the wisdom faculty already. So this is the first thing, is to get some of that wisdom from the Buddha, because you already have a degree of confidence and faith in the Buddhist teachings. But the other way of developing the wisdom faculty is to remember that our wisdom is very closely related to the defilements that we have in the mind. If you have a lot of defilements, your wisdom is going to be low. Wisdom is very closely related to vipassana. Vipassana is the idea of clear seeing. So if you see clearly, then if you keep on seeing clearly, then one day, bang, wisdom arises. You have some kind of insight into something. So vipassana and wisdom very closely related to each other. And vipassana is directly proportional. This is a mathematical term. It sounds like an equation. Vipassana is directly proportional or is inversely proportional to the defilements in your mind. I've got to write down that equation. So the more defilements you have, the less vipassana you have. The less defilements you have, the more vipassana you have. So by reducing your defilements, you are increasing your wisdom. So if you practice the virtue in ordinary life, if you try to overcome the defilements of the mind, you are, in that way, you are already increasing your wisdom. You are seeing things more clearly here. Another way to increase your wisdom is to reflect on some of those fundamental teachings of Buddhism. Reflect on impermanence, for example, and this is very useful. If I remember when Donald Trump was elected as president of the U.S., people were saying, "Oh no, what now? The world is going to go under," and all this kind of thing. Many people were very upset about it. Some people were very happy about it. Many people were very upset. Right? People are different. And then, of course, if these things upset you, and of course, there's plenty of things in the world to upset us. All you have to do is open a newspaper or go online. There's always something going on which is bad. People being bombed and blowing other people up and all this terrible stuff happening everywhere here. But that is anicca. That is exactly what we should expect in a certain way. When things don't go the way we expect things to, we think things should be going, that is precisely what the Buddha said. It is not going to go according to our expectations. It is inherently unreliable. So remember that. And that is basically every time something happens like that, which is difficult, which is hard to deal with, it means that we haven't really taken on board the teaching. And it is an opportunity for us to actually see, well, this is exactly what the Buddha said. And it makes us move our refuge from taking refuge in worldly things to taking refuge in the Dhamma instead. Because we understand that we can't take refuge in the world. It's inherently unstable. Don't know where it's going to go next. It's madness to take refuge there. Let's take refuge in something a bit more stable, like the teaching of the Buddha instead. Reflect on that impermanence, and that will kind of move you in a different direction. You will start to think of things in a different way, and this is one way of growing in wisdom. Reflect on your own death. You're going to die. You don't know when. It gives you the sense of now is my opportunity. Now I have a chance to do things. I'm going to die. Why am I hanging on to all these worldly things when I'm going to be out of here anyway? It's crazy. Let me instead invest in my own mind and do something positive for myself. So all of these are ways of growing in wisdom, learning to see things. But basically, come back to the teaching of the Buddha. Read those, reflect on those. And if you do that, gradually, you'll be heading in the right way here. Okay, I've got to hurry up. Okay. Dear AB, okay. Could you please talk about meditation and sleep? Are there transitional stages? Do dreams get different when one meditates more during the day? Is there meditation during sleep? Is there conscious sleeping? Thank you so much. Okay, well, this is your chance to experiment for yourself, right? So just meditate and see what happens at nighttime. See, maybe if you dream about meditation, that'd be really cool, right? That means you're really enjoying your meditation practice. And Ajahn Brahm told me about this dream that he had when he went into a deep stage of meditation as he was dreaming. Then he woke up because the bliss was so strong. Right? And then straight away into meditation. And that's pretty cool. So if that happens to you, it means you're heading in the right direction. If it doesn't happen to you, you should not feel too disappointed about that, because that's a pretty rare thing to happen. Do dreams get different when you meditate more during your day? Well, if your meditation goes well, it is not just about meditating as such, it's about how the meditation goes. If the meditation goes well and you feel that you are kind of purifying your mind, you are energized and all of these kind of things, then usually the sleep is very deep and very peaceful, usually. And that is one of the consequences of when meditation actually works properly here. Is there meditation during sleep? Well, I just gave you an example. That was Ajahn Brahm. I don't think, apart from that, I would say not really. When you are sleeping, you are sleeping. You can't really meditate at that time. There is a one of the reasons why this perhaps comes up is that if you read the standard passage on clear comprehension, we'll get maybe to this later on in the suttas, it says in there that you have sampajanya, sampajanakari, while you are, or not while, it says sutte, sampajanakari. And sutte means, can mean either in sleep or it can mean in regard to sleep. And very often it is translated as when sleeping. Right, so you are clear comprehension when sleeping, and then some people thought that that's it, that doesn't make any sense, so they changed the translation into clear comprehension when you fall asleep. The problem is, it doesn't mean that. It actually means in sleep. It actually means in regard to sleep. So the correct translation is actually you have clear comprehension not when you are sleeping, but in regard to sleep. It means that you know how much you're supposed to sleep. You know what time is the right time to get up, how many hours you need, that kind of stuff. That is the real meaning, as far as I'm concerned, of that passage. A lot of ink gets spilled over these kind of little things in the suttas, but actually they matter quite a bit to get these little things right, I think. So that is, as far as I'm concerned, the real meaning of that. So there is no meditation while you are sleeping, but the clarity of mind gives you much more information about what is the appropriate amount of sleep. So you sleep not too much, not too little, just right, to gain maximum clarity of mind. That's what it's all about. Is there conscious sleeping? That is what conscious sleeping is, right? Getting the right amount, that's what it really means. And there is, of course, there is what is that called again? Where you sleep and you take charge of your dreams? Lucid dreaming, that's right, lucid dreaming, yeah. So you have lucid dreaming, right, where you know that you are, I'm sleeping now, and then you take charge of your dream, and you can do all kind of stuff while you're dreaming. So try that, and try to meditate, yeah, and see what happens. That'd be really cool, wouldn't it? Because maybe the body is no problem at that point, yeah? Because the body is sleeping, so the body is out of the way. So that would be really cool. Check it out. If any one of you can do lucid dreaming, try to sit down and meditate during the lucid dream. See what happens. It'd be very interesting to try. Okay, so I hope that answers most of your question. If not, please come back to me here. Okay, dear Ajahn, what are your views on the idea of bodhisattva in Theravada Buddhism, especially the belief that a bodhisattva needs to fulfill certain conditions, paramis, I think they are called, before attaining Buddhahood? Thank you for all your wonderful teachings. That's very kind of you to say that. So, what are your views on the idea of bodhisattva in Theravada Buddhism? And I think somebody made the suggestion that the idea of bodhisattva in Theravada Buddhism was arose as a counterpoint to the idea of the bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, because the Theravadan said, well, they got bodhisattvas, we have to have bodhisattvas as well, right? It's like competing with the Joneses, that kind of stuff. We all have to have our bodhisattvas. But actually, the word bodhisattva, actually, as we shall see in one of these days, is that the word bodhisattva actually occurs in the suttas. But in the suttas, the meaning of the word bodhisattva is the Buddha, after he went forth from the home life into homelessness in his last life, just before he became a Buddha. That was when he was a bodhisattva, and he was a bodhisattva, he was a person in search, looking for awakening. That is the meaning, as far as I'm concerned, of bodhisattva in the most early discourses. But this whole idea that it is possible to become a Buddha by fulfilling the paramis and all of that, this is a later idea in Buddhism. It is not something that is found in the early Buddhist teachings. And I always wonder, when I see these kind of new ideas arising in Buddhism, they may have arisen for good reasons, and it's not good to kind of blame anyone or anything like that, but I always wonder, who has the authority to come up with these new ideas. Right? If the Buddha didn't teach this, if the Buddha said we should practice the Noble Eightfold Path and these kind of things, then who has the authority to say, well, actually, here is an alternative path. This path is do the 10 paramis, and then at the end of that you become the Buddha. Who knows about these things? Where does it come from? And it seems kind of dubious to me that somebody else, if the Buddha has taught a certain way, that somebody else should come around and find an alternative way. It doesn't seem right to me at all. So I tend to reject these things, and I really don't think that this is a valid path at all. If you look at how the Buddha himself came to be a Buddha, he came to be a Buddha almost by trial and error. In his last life, he was doing all the ascetic practices. It didn't work out. So he thought, okay, maybe this is wrong. Maybe I should go a different way. He didn't really know what he was doing. It's not as if he was practicing the 10 paramis and doing the right thing. He was completely on the wrong track. And he says so himself. He said, I had wrong view about these things. I didn't know what was going on. Yeah. So the Buddha himself was clearly recognized that he wasn't really following a path. He was on the wrong track very often. So if even the Buddha wasn't fulfilling the paramis, then, you know, what is this whole, where does this whole idea come from? And of course, many of the qualities that we talk about when we talk about fulfilling the paramis are very beautiful qualities, and they are certainly very worthwhile, but it's not as if they constitute a path in their own right. That is not what they are. They are just beautiful qualities, that's it, that we also can incorporate in the path if we want, but it's not going to make you a Buddha in the future. I think that is... That would be stretching the evidence way beyond what we know from the suttas. Okay, anyway, that's my take on it. So there you are here. Okay, dear Ajahn, secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states, you go to the first jhana. Means one have to lose all the six senses to enter jhana? Even the desire for joy, rapture, etc. will be a hindrance. So how to lose all six senses? You don't have to lose all six senses, only five, because the sixth sense in Buddhism is the mind itself, and you can't. The mind has to be there, but you have to lose the five senses that connect us to the external world. Yeah, that is what you have to lose, or you have to not really lose, but what you have to give up temporarily to be able to enter a jhana state. That is what it means, free from sense desire. I would say free from sensory experience. Kame vibhicheva kamehi. From the sensual objects, free from sensual objects, free from sensual experience is what that really means. Free from desire for joy and rapture. All of these things will not be a hindrance if the joy and the rapture is of the spiritual kind. If it is the joy that comes from watching the breath, from feeling good about yourself, from living life well, and all of these kind of things, it is a powerful support for taking you into samadhi. In fact, you need that to be able to enter samadhi. Not a hindrance at all. It is a support for these things. So that is what you do. And you do that. And then as you do that, the five senses disappear all on their own accord. There's nothing that you really have to do. I'm sure most of you will have had that feeling that when meditation deepens a little bit, it's as if the world outside recedes a little bit. It starts to become like weaker, less important to you. You're becoming more focused on the breath or whatever it is. Yeah, and the world outside is becoming less important. And that process just keeps on going, going and going, until eventually the external world goes completely. And you're completely within yourself, within your own world. And that is really the kind of what we talk about when we talk about deep samadhi states. It's a very natural process. You don't have to think about how to lose the senses at all. It just happens as a matter of course, as you follow the meditation process. Okay. Dear Ajahn, apologies to ask personal question, but it's related to meditation retreat. Ajahn Brahm told the story at his retreat that your sister had breast cancer. After attending 9-day retreat in London, her tumor shrunk 80%. Did your sister have surgery and chemo radiation? Is she continue to meditate to cure her cancer? It is interesting to know the benefits of meditation to get rid of something you don't want. Okay, so the answer is that it's very hard to know exactly what causes things to come and go, and how these things, what is the causes for these things to disappear or to arrive, and all of these kind of things. And very often you go through cycles, the cancer goes away for a while and it comes back again. At that time, it is quite possible that the retreat had a good effect on her and that kind of reduced the cancer. But I think recently it has been getting worse again. So it's not, things are always go up and down. And this is kind of right now, it is not, prognosis doesn't look very, very good as far as my sister is concerned. I think meditation is always very helpful. It's very powerful and very useful. And it kind of makes you more peaceful at the very least. And it certainly, if it still goes the wrong way, it will also, if you then were to take and, to die with that cancer, at the very least, you will have a more clear mind and you were able to die in a better way as a consequence. But also a positive mind state is well known to help to cure illnesses and these kind of things. So right now it is not looking so good. So I'm going to go, going back to Norway after this retreat. I'll be going to Europe fairly soon afterwards. I'll have a chance to chat with her when I go there and see what's happening here. So anyway, that's the short answer to that one. Okay, dear Ajahn, I was puzzled by what you said in last night's Q&A about how living as an Anagarika is not that different from being a bhikkhu, as I've heard you talk before on the value of bhikkhunis, and even what you said in today's sutta class about the enduring value of monasticism. How and would you advise a woman thinking of ordaining, given that there are probably few, if any, Aryan bhikkhuni teachers alive today in the Theravada world? Would it be better to become a Meichi, 8-precept nun, and have the opportunity to live a monastery with an Aryan, possibly Arahant bhikkhu teacher, and hear the Sadhamma? Or is there something inherently valuable in ordaining as a bhikkhuni, even if you live in a bhikkhuni monastery with no Aryan teacher? Thank you for your advice. First of all, it's very hard sometimes to know, to find a place, and you want to live in an Aryan monastery. It is very difficult to know exactly who these Aryans are. And sometimes it makes it very, you make a choice, you think you're going to live in a monastery with an Aryan teacher, but maybe that person turns out not to be an Aryan. You hope so. You think that they have a lot of good qualities, but it may not necessarily be the case. So because of that, it is very hard, very difficult to know sometimes. This is a very hard question to really answer. One of the ways to do this is to try out a few different things for yourself. Go to this monastery, see what it is like to live like an 8-precept nun, a Meichi, or a 10-preceptor, or whatever it is. Try it out and see what it feels like. And it may be that it is conducive. It may be that it is not. It depends on how the whole monastery is set up. It depends on how much time you have with the Aryan teacher. It depends on all kinds of things in that monastery. It's very hard to give a general piece of advice. Or there may be other monasteries where you don't have perhaps an Aryan teacher living in the monastery, but maybe still you have access to good Aryan teachings. Maybe they will be visiting monastics coming to that monastery. Maybe you have, you always have access to the word of the Buddha, if you wish. So again, it depends exactly on the circumstances, how much interaction you have with good teachers and the word of the Buddha and all of these kind of things. So I would suggest to anyone in that situation, try out a few things. Go and live for a few weeks in different places. See how it affects you. See if it is even possible, right? As long as you haven't tried it out, they are just ideas in your head, and you don't really know whether it's going to work out or not for you. So that is what I would suggest. Yeah, so you don't actually have to have a bhikkhuni who is an Aryan teacher, depending on if you live in a bhikkhuni monastery. There may be some bhikkhunis who are Aryan teachers. I don't know. It's quite possible that there is. But even if there isn't, you know, there is other ways of having access to those Aryan teachings. So try it out and see what happens. Okay, Ajahn, is yoniso manasikara, this is a favorite term obviously today, is it simply a matter of attending to the right thing, directing the mind, or does it also include how you attend to it? For example, if ill will arises in the mind towards somebody, you are supposed to turn the mind to attend to that person's good point. Or if lust arises, you turn your mind to their ugly points. Is that basically it? Or is there more you can explain about how part of careful attention? Thank you. Okay, so if ill will arises towards somebody, there are many things you can do depending on the situation. You can turn your attention completely away from that person, right? So if you are meditating, for example, and you get this image of somebody in your mind that you don't really want to think about, you can, if you are quick and just forget about them straight away, you can just carry on with your breath meditation and there will be no residue in your mind from that person. That's one way of doing it. Just pointing your attention in a completely different direction and forgetting about that person. That is one way. Another way of doing it is precisely as you say, to then remember the positive qualities in that person, right? To bring those to mind. And if you do that and you have developed that perception of positive qualities in the past very strongly, so you have clarity about those good qualities, then the bad qualities will disappear like that. Bang, it will be gone completely because of the power of that perception. It's almost like you're plucking a perception off the shelf, a perception that is ready to use because you have developed it before. Pluck it off the shelf and you use it and the negative state vanishes in a very powerful way. I'll talk more about this later on. Or if it is a very difficult person, you have compassion for them because of their difficult points. And then you don't focus so much on yourself. You focus on the other person and have compassion instead. Yes, or you can remember the dangers in this. Just remind yourself, why? I'm here on this beautiful retreat. Why on earth am I thinking about this person? They're not even here, right? There's no problem right now. And I'm thinking about this silly thing here. This is just destroying a meditation, destroying the happiness here. No, I don't want to think about that. Bang, back on the meditation subject. You know it, you're being silly, and so you go back to the meditation again. All of these things are yonaso manasikara. Whatever you use to abandon that perception of ill will and abandon the ill will, if it works, especially if it works very powerfully, that is yonaso manasikara. And the same thing, if you are attracted to somebody, exactly the same thing, and that attraction arises in the mind, it is how you reflect on that person that will then abandon that attraction. You will lose your interest. You know that it is a silly kind of infatuation. You know that it's not going to go anywhere. It's just going to give a rise to future suffering and problems and all of these kind of things in the same way. And that way you abandon that. It is more difficult with sensuality because it is something that is much more pleasurable. Ill will is inherently painful, much easier to get rid of. Sensuality much harder. But if you are wise about it, you can give up these things as well. And look at things in a different way. Okay, so I hope that helps. Let's do a couple of more here. Dear Ajahn, I have heard it said that the Buddha displayed some psychic powers. The Maha Pratyahara, which is the... Anyway, and later when monks also started to display these, he banned any such display. Is this in the original scripture or is this a later addition? There is a story in the Vinaya Pitaka where I don't know if this is how true this story is or whatever, but there was apparently a man who said that he had what did he do? He had a bowl, I think, on a stick, on a kind of tall pole, and he put the bowl on top of the pole. And he said, any monk who's able to fly up and get that ball from the top of the pole, he will get that ball or something like that. And then that's when the Buddha laid down, this is not appropriate. You shouldn't kind of be using psychic powers for this kind of thing. Something like that. And that is when the idea of displaying psychic powers was basically banned, and you're not supposed to display such things. It is said that the Buddha displayed some psychic powers. There are very few instances in the suttas where that seemed to happen, but generally speaking, I consider those instances fairly unreliable. After all, the Buddha said that he detested, he was disgusted with the psychic powers, not with the psychic power as such, but with kind of using them to convert people and these kind of things. So I think a lot of those things are not really original. And this is one of the things that comes out when you do things like a comparative study of the suttas, you look at the various recension of the suttas. Some of these things that are more part of the narrative, part of the story, background around the suttas is often not that reliable. It varies quite a lot between the different recensions. So I must admit, I don't take these things very seriously myself, and I don't think the Buddha was somebody who would use psychic powers very much at all. That is my feeling about that. And there will be many people who disagree with that. But anyway, that's my feeling about it. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is there such places like heaven and hell? Hell is one spontaneously rebirth when no one is inclined to go. How is this imposed? Is one spontaneously reborn when no one is inclined to go? How is this imposed? Okay, are there such thing as heaven and hell? Are there bad, is there bad rebirth among humanity? There is. You can be reborn in a good place or in a bad place in humanity. So there is going to be bad destinations beyond that. Hell is just a name, right? It's just a word. It sounds pretty dismal, hell. It sounds pretty bad. But it's just a name for something, a bad name for some kind of bad rebirth. That's really all it means. So if you're not inclined to go there, how is this imposed? And I think a very nice way of looking upon that is to think that you actually impose that upon yourself. When you come to the end of your life, you know that you have done many bad things. One of the things that is often talked about when people talk about having near-death experience, very often have a life review when they have a near-death experience. I know many people who've had that kind of life reviews. So it seems to happen. It seems to be very real. And when you have that life review, you see everything you've done. And when you see everything you've done, and you see perhaps the consequences of what you have done on other people, you have no choice but to judge yourself. And then you will judge yourself one way or another. And then if you judge yourself badly, you are the one who send yourself off to a bad destination. You impose that penalty on yourself because you are the judger. Nobody else is judging this. And this is really how karma tends to work. Just like karma works in this life, you do something bad, you feel bad about yourself. You are judging yourself. That's really what's going on. And here is the big judgment when you die. You send yourself off to that bad destination. You send yourself off to the good destination. You send yourself off to becoming a human being again in the future. So you have to take responsibility for these things. So that's how it works. So you are your own kind of judge. And I think that is pretty much how things actually look in the suttas as well. The suttas basically said there's a nice sutta called the Devadutta Sutta in the Anguttara 3s, which talks about that particular thing, how actually this kind of whole process seems to happen. Dear Ajahn, you spent 1 hour explaining the Buddha Guna, the 9 qualities of the Lord Buddha. It was awesome. Choice of language, words, phrases, tone of delivery was superb. You are a wonderful teacher. May you attain nirvana in this life. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, well, that's very kind of you to say all that. So the Buddha Guna is the qualities of the Buddha. That's what the word Buddha Guna actually means. Okay, great. So that's very, very nice. Maybe we should stop there, right? That's nice place to stop. No, okay, we'll do a couple of more. Life tends to lack a purpose. Essentially, you go to work, come home, eat, maybe watch some TV, and then sleep and repeat. That sounds pretty miserable, doesn't it? Sounds pretty depressing. Okay. How can one add some meaning into life? Yeah, this is a very good...
Ordain.
Okay, yeah. That is a good way, but... When you ordain, I would agree with that. When you ordain, one of the great things about being a monastic is that you really feel that you are living a very meaningful existence. Almost everything you do has meaning. You're not living to make a living anymore. You're not making any money. Everything you do is for charitable purposes or is to develop yourself on the spiritual path. And that is a very meaningful life to live as a monastic. But of course, it is very useful to make lay life more meaningful as well. And the way to make lay life meaningful, to make any life meaningful, is to remember it is not what you do that matters so much, but how you do things. So you start doing things with the right intention, doing things in the right way. When you go to work, you ask yourself, how can I do my work in such a way as to be a benefit for other people? Right, when you go to work, you have customers, you have colleagues and co-workers, there's all these people around that you affect by your work. So you ask yourself, how can I put some kindness into what I'm doing so it would be beneficial for myself and also for all of these other people? It is amazing how by changing our attitude a little bit, changing your intention a little bit, almost anything can be turned into something positive that is a support for your spiritual practice. Family life, the same thing, right? Okay, watching TV, I'm not sure how you turn that into a positive thing, but I would just turn off the TV and instead kind of do some meditation instead, right? Far better way of spending your time. There is tremendous scope in any kind of life. Every moment, if you live it in the right way, can be made a part of your spiritual path. It is about your intention, your attitude, how you do things that really matters, not so much what you do. And that is true for lay life, is also true for monastic life. It's possible to waste your monastic life completely because you live the monastic life for the wrong reasons and all of this kind of stuff. It is possible to live your lay life in a beautiful way. And of course, vice versa in both situations. So remember, how is what matters. What is not so important. And then you are on the right track. And hopefully, maybe one day you can, as Venerable over here, Venerable Santacharya, maybe one day you can even ordain, right? Whoa, what a wonderful thing that is to be able to do that as well. Anyway, I'm going to stop there because it's getting late, and we're going to use these clothes pegs to peg the few remaining questions, and we'll do those first thing tomorrow morning. Okay. You want to do that, Venerable? Yeah? Great.